Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 72, An Interview with the Case File Arkham Crew. It's been a while since I've done a Solitaire Rose solo episode, mostly because I've been focusing on the main show and getting some other stuff in place, but get ready! It's a new year, and got a whole bunch of new stuff coming. Right now, they've been on the show before, you know these guys. Josh Finney, Patrick McAvoy, Kat Rocha, the team that gave us Case File Arkham, and now Case File Arkham. Let me grab the book here. It's right here. Case File Arkham, Her Blood Runs Cold, a Mark Flynn PI story. You can get this from their website at 01publishing.com. You can also get it at Amazon. You can buy it digitally at either one. We talk not just about the book, but about the whole creative process behind the Case File Arkham stuff, the mixing of Lovecraft and detective stories. By the way, if you like detective stories, head on over to Novelcast. That's novels.solitairerose.com because I'm doing a detective story based in the world of 80s professional wrestling over there, and it's going to be wrapping up over the next 2 months. Wow, that's a plug. Anyway, I've had these guys on before. I really enjoyed their work. And the other thing about it is that the first Case File Arkham book was a lot of fun, very well done. This one is the next step up. It's not just a sequel, it's a better book. It shows that their collaboration's working better, the art is working better, and Josh is growing as a writer, Patrick is growing as an artist. They've got a lot of stuff over at 01 Publishing, and as I say in the interview, it's one of the few publishers where no matter what they put out, I'm going to buy it. I just enjoy the stuff they do. I think you'll enjoy listening to us talk about them. Now, we had a little technical difficulty as we started recording, and Josh could hear us, but he couldn't say anything. So, of course, Patrick told a rousing story about a elderly Chinese barmaid who was giving Josh a rather rough time. So we returned to that joke over and over and over in this episode. And maybe, just maybe, I will put that on an episode in the future so that you can hear that part next time we have the guys on the show. But here it is, the crew from Case File Arkham, Her Blood Runs Cold. Well, you guys have had a blockbuster success. What was it? Like 3 years ago when I had you on for World War Kaiju. You guys,
yes.
And Patrick has been on the show more than any other guest, by the way.
Woohoo!
I don't know if that's a good thing for him, but it's a great thing for me.
Aw, thank you.
But you guys made the Amazon bestseller list. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I saw that a couple of days ago when you were hyping that the digital version of the book was cheaper.
We've actually hit the top 100. Actually, we've hit the top 20 multiple times over the last couple of months, which has been very, very rewarding.
And not easy. And,
yeah.
And what I wanted to ask first off, the last time we talked was when you were starting this project. You know, you had a few pages done, you had the script done, you were doing the Kickstarter. As you created this second book, what was easier than you thought it would be, and what was much harder than you thought it would be?
Ooh. Hey, I don't know if we've gotten that question yet. Well done, Corey.
That's my job. I try to think up new questions that don't have to do with the Chinese barmaids.
And you know, she was actually directly from China. It was kind of an exchange program at the Marriott. So.
Although now she'll be shipped out, you know. Sorry.
Yeah, in disgrace.
So your memories are all you will have.
Actually, you want the truth. You know, the thing was, I was a little drunk, But she also obviously had this kind of deer in the headlights look. I mean, she was in San Francisco. She was from China. I think she had been dealing with a lot of weirdos, and I probably just made it worse. But
now, do you get that look a lot, the deer in the headlights look, when you talk to people?
No. I mean, her doing her job, she kind of looked like she didn't know what the hell, you know, just...
Oh.
You know, San Francisco's kind of an odd place.
I've heard that. Although, nice great comic time. Shops. Great comic shops.
Great comic shops. And
so, what was harder this time around? How about for you, Patrick?
What was harder? Well, okay, we'll start with harder. What was harder? I think what was harder was... I was trying to expand the look of it. The first time around, I just kind of dived in because I have never done, you know, a lot of inking before. I had never done an actual ink style comic book, you know, pen and ink look like this one has. And so the first one, I was just kind of, you know, diving in and, you know, flailing around and having that kind of that kind of exhilarating fun that you have when you try something new. And then on the second one, I don't know, kind of was tightening up just a little bit, kind of, you know, consolidating what I'd learned and getting it off the ground was a little more difficult this time. I was staying on model with the characters a lot better, and I had come up with a lot of ways to do the textures and the sort of our noir, really solid blacks and lots of, you know, detailed hatching and stuff. So that I kind of had down, but it was just I had tightened up somewhat, and so I guess for me the hard part, if I'm gonna sum it all up, was feeling loose and comfortable with it again. Because the first one, I was too dumb to know what I couldn't do. I just dived right in. So this time, I'd say the first 15 pages or so are kind of tighter than I would have wanted. But then I started loosening up, and that was okay.
Another thing you did in this one, you tried other styles as well. Different artistic influences showed in different sections.
Well, the first book did that too, but just not as much.
Right.
Yeah, I was probably trying to do it and not doing it as well, but I was glad when you did your review of our book a couple of weeks ago, thank you very much, that you had picked up on that. Because, yeah, each little arc of the story, I really... was trying to give it its own visual look, and I was really happy you picked up on that. But yeah, as Josh says, I was trying to do that in the last one, but it probably wasn't quite as, because I didn't really know as much of what I was doing at that point. So yeah, that's great. Thanks.
And Josh, for you, what was harder, doing a second book with these, with the character and in this world?
I would say the hardest thing for me was that I did not have a buffer to start writing the script. I mean, literally, we just jumped right into it. The Kickstarter, the way the things fell together, I did not really have time to prep and have a certain number of pages ready beforehand. So I was writing at a certainly a much more rapid pace. And then it wasn't until the art was done that then I'd go back and do all the tightening. So that was definitely a bit more difficult for me. Other than that, really, that is it. I mean, everything else on my end was easier this time around. I had a much better feel of the characters. I had a much better sense of what I wanted. The first book had established a lot of things that I didn't have to worry about this time around. If the character needed to know something, he could just refer back to the first book saying, oh, yeah, well, yeah, I've seen monsters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the theme this time around, whereas the first one, you got to think, in 1940, you know, the world wasn't quite as explored as it is now. And the notion of, you know, some unknown species of creature living underground in the sewers isn't really that outlandish. I mean, there was plenty about the world we didn't know. I could buy it, right? This time around, you know, we're talking about pagan gods and baby sacrifices and giant things living under the ocean. It's a bit more of a leap, you know?
Yeah.
Which was a lot of fun. And so in that regard, it allowed me to be a little bit more vague. So, yeah.
One of the things when you do continuing characters,
yeah,
when you're doing a self-contained book, you can have a character go through a character arc where there's a lot of change in that character. But if it's a series character, like Travis McGee can't change too much because there's 23 books. He's got to kind of essentially stay the same character. Do you think that that kind of helps you with the story in that your character can now be sort of, I always call it a clothesline to hang the story on. Your character's the one constant, and the story is what changes when you have a series character.
You know, I never really thought about it that way. My initial intent, and I still intend to do it this way, is that when we first meet Flynn, he's just a guy back from the war, and sure, some weird things have happened to him, but even he's not too aware of it. As far as he's concerned, the world he lives in is no different than our own. And so we're with him as he's kind of peeling away the veil and realizing that there's things in the shadows. And I wanted that specifically because there is a huge market for the wizard detective, the occult detective. It's apparently a lot bigger than I realized it was, but the one thing I disliked about the genre is literally every time you came to it, the detective already knew everything. And I wanted this guy just to be an average Chandler-esque detective. Sure, he's got some dark things in his past that he didn't know about or didn't quite understand. But so that he was kind of discovering this supernatural world with you. And as the series progresses, he will develop into someone who's very comfortable with this, and he starts to get kind of a knowledge of it. He's going to be less and less skeptical. I mean, again, in the first book, the idea that there is a species of ghoul living under the city isn't a massive leap compared to there are cosmic gods waging wars, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, That is a far deeper twist for him. And, you know, then there's all the stuff going on with his love of his life, Glinda, which will continue to develop. So, I don't know. Actually, I had always kind of intended him to grow as a character and to become more familiar, more comfortable with the world he's in.
So, you see, now do you have a number of stories that you want to do, or is this something that you could do till you're no longer able to hit on the Chinese waitresses?
Oh,
yeah, we're going to go back. We're going to pound that joke because that's what I do.
it's going to reach the not funny stage for a while, but towards the end of the interview, it's going to be funny again.
Well, Patrick and I were talking about Letterman. That was Letterman's thing where, you know, something's funny, and then he keeps doing it, and it's not funny anymore, and then it hits a point where it becomes the funniest thing you've ever heard. I'm hoping to get to that point, but usually it just stays where it's not funny.
Well, you see, the thing is, if I wasn't hooked up with already, a very attractive woman I love, it would probably annoy the shit out of me. Like, it would probably really get on my nerves, but considering I've got such a good thing with Kat, it's just funny. Seriously, it's just funny.
Well, it's supposed to be. But do you see, like, you have, like, a certain number of books in your head, or just an ongoing sort of thing?
There are a number of stories that I do want to tackle, but ideally I'd love to see this go on until I'm thoroughly burnt out and have no more ideas.
Yes. Me too. There's a lot we can tell in this world because it's nice because it formed organically as Josh and I were talking about, you know, how we wanted to do a story. You know, what kind of Lovecraft story would we want to tell? Well, we don't like the Lovecraft heroes, and then we're saying, well, we both like, you know, detective noir. What if we did, you know, it was sort of a natural conversation we did that evolved into this. It wasn't just some, you know, idea that, you know, what are we going to do that'll be popular, you know, that'll make money. It was more, yeah, what sort of story would we like to read? And so because we've done that and we've worked on it as an overall world rather than just something where the world is built to prop up a plot, it's the plots can be hung on this world, like you say, like a clothesline. But it's not just the character, it's the whole world we've created. So, yeah, there's a lot for us to do.
A few things I can give away is at some point a major story arc has to eventually culminate in Innsmouth. For anybody in on the Lovecraft lore, they will understand why that's significant. But when that comes, we'll see. When I feel that there's been enough foreshadowing and building of the universe, that'll eventually happen.
Now, Patrick and I were talking a little earlier while we were having our Skype problems about how Lovecraft seems to be one of the few pulp authors who 100 years on isn't just still read, but people are still pulling ideas out of his mythos. And the first thing I wanted to ask Josh is, when were you introduced to the whole Cthulhu mythos?
I was introduced in my early teen years when I was the kid who he and his friends always went down to the comic book store and hung out and played D&D. And there was a nice big wall full of Chaosium books there.
Okay.
And just going through them and seeing just how utterly bizarre and different this mythology was than anything we'd ever seen before, that it was kind of hard not to be fascinated by it. I mean, and it's probably one of the reasons that it's endured as well as it has. I mean, one of the fun things that I'll eventually hopefully get across in Case File Arkham is there are no vampires in this world. There are no werewolves. There's none of that traditional stuff. It's, you know, these are, you know, more in line with Lovecraft's creations, which are more disturbing and far less relatable.
And one of the things about the Case File Arkham, when you announce a book, it takes about a year overall.
Yes.
And is this a project that kind of consumes all of your time, or are you working on things on the side? Because if this is all you're doing, I don't want you to end up like Herbert West or any of the other characters who, you know, have delved too far into it and have gone mad.
Well, people keep telling me I look like a deranged Jeffrey Combs, so I think I've already lost that one. But yeah, it takes, for me, it consumes all my time. I don't know about Patrick, but that is the most difficult part about it is, you know, I'm doing the layout. Our scripting process is pretty intensive. I do the lettering and I write the story. I don't have time to do anything else during that period. And so in that regard, these need to hit a certain profit level where I just can't do them.
Yeah, I unfortunately can't take that much time on them. When I'm working on it, it's probably about, 75% of my time, but I have to do other things to keep more income coming in, or else I will will be out on the street. So, but they're a lot. Each page takes me about 14 hours. So either a long day or most of a day and a little of the next one. So it's pretty time consuming.
But I intend to spend this next year working on my prose, and then the rest of that time working nonstop promoting this book so that it finds its audience. I mean, we've got a strong audience. It's very niche, but it's really an issue that people just don't know it exists. I mean, it's very rare for people who like this stuff to see it and not immediately get attached to the title.
Yeah, I've actually been really happy that everyone who does read it seems to like it. And we've gotten a lot of reviews, which is good. So people read it and then they feel that they want to review it. So a couple of people have had sort of lukewarm reviews, and that's always, and they've been honestly upfront because they don't like Lovecraft and or they don't like noir. Yeah. So if you don't like both of those, then, you know, the fact that you've even read the book is a triumph. But the reviewers have been exceptionally kind, like yourself. And so that gives me hope that, you know, as it, you know, continues to build up an audience, people won't forget about it. They'll seek out the next books as we do them. And hopefully it'll build.
Actually, the very best thing that fans of the book can do, and any of your listeners who like the book, I just urge you, please, if you want to see this book flourish and continue, the best thing you can do is go onto Amazon and review it. You know, magazine reviews don't really count for much anymore. Podcasts like this do us a lot of help. But ultimately, for people to find out about the book, the best thing you can do is review it on Amazon, because then Amazon will start showing the book to other people. So that is the number one thing. If fans can review it, it increases the odds of another book coming sooner.
Exactly. It's like everybody these days is learning about how to get around the Facebook algorithms that hide your posts, except for certain people. You know, there's little tricks you can do, and we're all having to learn those. And on Amazon, the main trick is to get a lot of customer reviews. And then
the nice thing about Amazon is they're not really working against you. Amazon is more than willing to help you. They want to know this information. Yes.
They
want
to make money.
And if a fan reviews the book, they'll say, oh, well, this guy also read all these other books. Maybe the people who read those books might be interested. Mm-hmm. And the more people that do that review, help us. And yeah, that is the number one thing out there that I would ask fans to do, other than don't pirate the book.
That goes without saying. I don't think they're fans if they pirated the book. They're leeches.
Yeah, at least, you know, if you can't afford the book, go to your library and ask them to get it, because not only is that a sale, but libraries, if something does well, they'll go, oh, let's get other stuff by these people. And it will also kind of push the publishing arm that you have, because it's not just Josh Publishing, it's an entire publishing arm. You talked a little earlier about how you do the book. In all the times we've talked, we've never talked about the working style. Josh, you said you do layouts.
Yeah.
So why don't you walk us through sort of the creative process? Because you don't have a main office in New York with a publishing editor who's, you know, pushing all this stuff and bringing in everyone. This is kind of you're doing it out of your house.
Well, most people are now, you know.
Yeah. But what is the process rather than, well, I write my script and I give it to this person and they draw it and they give it to the next person, they ink it and on down the line. How do you guys work? What's your working process?
Well, the beginning point is that, you know, Patrick and I have a very solid understanding of what the world looks like. I can trust him. You know, if I say I need a city street, I don't have to describe it. I can trust that he's going to know the mood of the scene and what a city street's going to look like in the 40s and what kind of lighting he's going to. And it's better because, you know, he's an artist. It's best to trust the artist and let, you know, he's got all this talent. Let him show it off. Don't let, you know, those Alan Moore scripts where they're like a phone book. I can only imagine those poor artists want to kill themselves.
Well, but I've read those scripts and they're more like a letter to the artist. And the most beautiful thing about one of them I read, because I was trying to learn how that's done, After this really long description, Alan Moore then wrote, although if that doesn't work, fuck it, draw something better.
Yeah. Which is a great policy. If you can trust your artist, that is a wonderful policy to have. But beyond, first we have an understanding. You know, we know what the characters look like. We both have a very shared vision of the world. I like to actually do a rough layout on the page and put the words and narration on the page beforehand, so it allows me to control the movement of the speech bubbles and text to pull the eye. And it also gives Patrick a sense of which panels I feel are the most important and, you know, how much space he's got to work with, so that nothing gets hidden behind speech bubbles or, you know, it's all one complete piece of art. And then I'll also just, you know, collage together references and vague ideas of what I'm thinking and hand it over to Patrick. And it's all basically a suggestion. It's, again, reference. And then he just goes from there. And, yeah, I would say, you know, 99% of the time, anything he changes, I'm like, that's the better choice.
Yeah, it's very good to have his idea of where the word balloons are going to go. In ooh, that was an interesting sound.
Oh, great.
All right, who's getting their hair cut?
Sounds like a scene from Marathon Man. Somebody's being tortured with
hello.
Tooth drills.
Is it safe?
Yes.
Is it safe?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it's safe.
Very good.
Well, anyway.
So, so Josh does the word layout, which is kind of useful because another great thing about how we do this is that Josh's script at that point does not have to be final. It's sort of his ideas of here's pretty much what this person's going to say and pretty much how long they're going to take to say it. So I know how to lay things out from that point. And then I might change the size of the various panels, or I might, you know, move them around on the page. But I have his initial idea, and I often just kind of cut out the word balloons that he's put there and kind of move them around on the page to make sure everything's going to work. But then it's very improvisational as much as it can be in this sort of thing, sort of slow motion improvising, because then I'll take that and I'll start doing the characters and the environment and the world that they're in and, you know, what emotions they're having and whatnot, and send it back to Josh. Then he will do his final script based on the things I've done. And so rather than just being this one way, you know, you throw stuff over the wall and the next person gets it, and you throw it over the wall and the next person gets it, you know, because of this, it kind of swings a little bit, you know. It's got it's got a very organic back and forth between the words and the pictures, which sometimes you don't get in a comic book, frankly.
Yeah, you can see that, well, especially in, like, comics where it was, you know, plot, art, script. I can't tell you how many times I can look at the art and go, yeah, the writer's fixing things in the dialogue.
Right.
And what it's one of the reasons why people say that writer-artists are better at comics, because they're able to do that organic thing. But it sounds like you guys have really kind of worked out how to do it organically, even though you've got different pieces that you're working through.
Well, I illustrated my first two books with Kat, and I was very hands-on doing the art myself, so I have kind of an understanding of kind of how the process works. Mm-hmm. And so I think in that part it makes it kind of easier to work with Patrick and communicate with him.
Yeah, we do, actually, we do some things where, you know, if I'm under the gun or if Josh has a particular idea, he'll put together a background. There's probably like four or five panels at least that Josh did, you know, 90% of the background on it. So, yeah, that's helpful, too.
I like doing architecture.
Yeah.
I enjoy doing it. But, and since it's kind of time consuming, it does save Patrick time. So
yeah. So I'll get his thing that he's put together that looks beautiful. And then I'll go in with Photoshop and mess up the perspective a little. That's part. Yeah. Add a little texture. That's actually part of our world. That's real subtle, is that none of the architecture is exactly along the proper perspective lines. You know, every building that you're seeing in any sort of perspective, the lines don't actually line up, you know, even if it's something that's based on a photograph that we've adjusted, you know, I've gone in and played with that. So yeah, it's a subtle thing that gives Arkham a weird feel, at least in the back of your head. You know, you're not quite settled properly in any given scene.
See, that's the sort of thing I find interesting, because when you read the book, you do get kind of a feel that things aren't quite right, but you can't pinpoint it. What other sort of subtleties are you putting in where, you know, let's say you have something in book one that won't pay off till book three or four? Are you planning that much in detail, or is it more happy accidents?
Oh, well, you know, any project creatively, especially a collaboration, but even just working on my own, you're going to get those happy accidents, or often you'll find that your subconscious was already working towards something that you weren't aware of. I mean, that happens quite a bit.
Well, there's one big one that I'm sure people have noticed, is that we keep mentioning a mob boss of the Innsmouth mob. Big Eddie Sturgeon, and we've mentioned him. We've had people working for him. We've shown him in like one or two panels, and that's been it. So you know he's got to come up at some point. Josh has been very careful with that.
Dagon keeps getting mentioned, so something about that.
Mm-hmm.
No, there is a lot of things that are being set up for later on. You know, it's just as long as the story can run, there's material that can be drawn upon. This book definitely, if you had kind of a sense that there was going to be more to come in the first book, this second one confirms it a lot of the time. I mean, you start to get Glenda's background and you realize there is a whole world there that is going to be uncovered. Now, you start getting Flynn's relationship with the cop Sinclair. You realize there's more going on there. The war flashbacks. And, you know, there's even... I don't think it's a big reveal. You actually are getting glimpses of Glinda's mother in this.
Oh, yeah, she's very important in the second one, actually. She's sort of a linchpin to a couple of scenes. So yeah, you don't really meet her per se, you know, get to know her character, but she's definitely in it. And so yeah, little characters like that are given pivotal roles, and you know that they're going to be important later. So that gives the overall feeling that it's a larger world and things are going to be happening. And we definitely have been setting all of that up. So yeah, we just have to pay it off one of these days.
And this book really did focus on, you know, one of the underlying themes is the gods. You know, in the first one, it's kind of touched upon, but, it's more, again, you know, curses and creatures under the creatures of the night and that kind of, you know, serial killers. Mm-hmm. This one, it really is, you know, there are greater forces at work. And just how much of this is real and how much of it isn't, and... But that's the groundwork that was really being established this time around.
Now, you two have kind of worked together now for, 3 years? On these three different books that you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even longer. When did we start? 2011 did we start working on World War Kaiju?
Yeah. That got delayed forever, but then finally came out.
That had a long gestation.
So what is the secret origin of this partnership?
Oh, it's a pretty prosaic one. Yeah, we were both doing books that were published by Arkea, the the late RKI. I think it's been absorbed into the body of Boom Studios now.
We
met at a couple of conventions. I think San Diego Con and probably WonderCon when it was in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And we got to know each other and found that our interests overlapped significantly.
Actually, it was the Chinese waitress. After that, he's like, I got this guy's too damn entertaining. I'm going to get some real laughs watching this guy.
I could not stay away from that. No, and so we definitely got to know each other. And when Josh was starting to work on World War Kaiju, he, you know, asked me if I'd be interested in doing some character design, and he couldn't get rid of me after that.
Because the two books, the two series, I should say, are very different.
Yeah.
Was it hard to jump from one to the other?
No, because I feel that this was far more in line with Patrick's heart and soul.
That's true. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We did a few pages of the next World War Kaiju book, and one of the things in World War Kaiju, and anybody who wants to look that up can feel free to look it up on Amazon. It's a fun first volume where what if we invented giant monsters instead of the nuclear bomb in World War II, and how would the Cold War play out given that? That was a great idea that I loved playing with, but it wasn't my own idea, obviously. In this case, it was Josh. The interesting thing is that when we started the second book, which we still haven't been able to follow through on, mostly due to monetary concerns, one of the several pages we did, I did in black and white. One of the conceits of the book is that we keep changing art styles as we go through, depending on different, I mean, completely changing the art styles, not just the mood, but, you know, there's one area that I did like Steranko's love story from Marvel in the late 60s. When we introduced the Carl Sagan character, I just go into two pages of flat out psychedelic Steranko, and there's some other areas. One looks like Al Williamson in EC, and you know, so on and so forth. So in the second one of the pages we did, I did as a black and white noir, you know, in a wet alleyway at night. And as I was doing that, I was thinking, boy, I'd like to work in this style a little more. And then as soon as we came up with this idea for Case File Arkham, I said, okay, that's how I want to, you know, approach this book. So it's interesting that it did kind of, there is a bit of an overlap between World War Kaiju and Case File Arkham. And it's that one page that I did that, ooh, that got my creative juices going.
Yeah, and the moment we decided we were doing noir, it had to be black and white.
Just absolutely.
Well, yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you were asking things that are planned for ahead and what's next and what's going on. I mean, are there any specific things that you are wondering about? I mean, it's amazing how much of this book shaped up because I had fans saying, well, I want to know more about this.
This is going to sound a little strange. I don't kind of read anymore looking forward. I let the creators take me on the ride, because too many times, especially with reviewers, and I'm doing more reviews on the regular podcast, I hear a reviewer go, well, if I were doing this story, I would have da-da-da-da-da. We don't care what you would have done with the story.
No.
It's, did the story work? Did the people do something that they set out to do? And is it entertaining? So I really don't kind of get in that headspace anymore. So when I'm reading stuff, it's like when I get on a roller coaster, I'm just there for the ride. But you talked about how you're going to be doing prose for the next year. That's very different from doing comics. It's all different muscles. And as someone who's kind of switched between the two, what is the what do you think doing comics has done to help your prose, and what has it done to kind of make your prose harder?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
God, Corey sucks as an interviewer.
They're too
entirely. That's it, I'm out of here!
They're so vastly different. I mean, I suppose there are some writers that could say there's a connection, but the way I work, no. It's an entirely different approach.
Is the plotting done in kind of the same way in your head, or when you're writing prose, do you just not think as visually?
Yeah, it has to be less visual. I mean, with comics, everything, you know, the visual comes first. And, I mean, the best comics pages are when they're drawn so well that you don't need to put the words in, you know. Whereas this, you're having to, you know, build everything through the lens of the text. So, yeah, no, it's just, it's again, a different kind of medium. As far as plotting's concerned, we'll see. I write very, very different stuff compared to the comics. I mean, I would like to try my hand at some Case File Arkham short stories or novels, but it's just an entirely different world for me.
And Patrick, I know that when you're not working on this stuff, you're doing, you've said in the past you do some commercial work, things like that. What, your outside work, how has that helped you do the constant improvement that you see through the art in the two Case File Arkham books? What is it that you're bringing in from that?
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of it has to do with my my constantly working as any, you know, any commercial artist has to do. You know, you're hand to mouth, and you've got to be, you know, always looking for new jobs. And in my case, that's also coupled with the fact that I do get a thrill out of doing as many different things as possible. So I work on, you know, kids' multimedia projects, and I work on mobile apps, and I work on, I've done a lot of work for college level CD-ROM accompaniments to textbooks and courses, just finished doing a illustrated novel a few months ago, which is real exciting. So, and then, of course, I've always done role-playing game work, all of that is to say that I think that the fact that I'm constantly working and then constantly switching from one thing to another really has helped me hone my sense of, I won't say professionalism, because I'm kind of on the borderline on that. I like to think I'm professional, but come on, who really is? But my sense of being able to direct my work in a particular direction, so that when I get a new project, I very quickly kind of arrange in my mind, okay, what's going to be needed? You know, what are the building blocks I'm going to need to get from point A to B to C to get this thing done? And I think it really has helped in my comic book pages to direct that, because a lot of people look at a page that I do and they'll say, wow, that only took you a day or so. And I say, well, yeah, but it, you know, at this point, I kind of know what I'm doing heading into it. So I get up in the morning and I say, I know what each panel is going to need by the end of the day. And I know what I'm going to have to do to lay the groundwork here and there. And so as I'm doing it, it's almost like I've envisioned it in my head. And that really does help. And I think that comes from, you know, jumping back and forth between so many different styles and different mediums. I've had to do that to keep making a living. And yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. Stylistically, there's not a lot of overlap, though.
And that is why every one of your listeners needs to go out and buy Case File Arkham 1 and 2 and then leave a great review on Amazon so that Patrick and I don't have to worry about scraping by as we provide you this beautiful entertainment.
And we could get it more often.
Actually, that's true. Yeah, you could.
You could, depending on how our sales go on this. I'd love to do more.
And the thing that really kind of bothers me, or yeah, I don't know, it's always the frustration of when you're doing it yourself, is we would not be able to do a book of this quality for a major. It just would not be allowed for the amount of time and care we put into it. The content would often be probably a little too controversial. But at the same time, without a major behind you, without Diamond supporting you, it's very hard for your audience to know you exist. And I know for a fact that the moment people know this book exists on a larger level, it's going to sell that much better. I mean, I have yet to have a negative reaction to this title. If they're into this stuff, this is like, where has this book been all my life?
Well, that was the other thing that I wanted to ask about is 01 Publishing is sort of slowly growing.
Mm-hmm.
And your motto is no safe spaces. Is there anything in your head where you would go, that's too far?
But it depends on context and how it's portrayed. I mean, if it's just exploitive, there were those grindhouse films in the 70s where the whole point was just hacking people up. Is that really dangerous or is it just exploitive? Actually, in a lot of ways, it is safe. It's exactly what you expect it to be. The most dangerous thing, I believe, is the ideas and the cultural norms and the things that are being challenged. You know, we're telling fully rounded characters. You know, we're showing things that otherwise wouldn't be allowed in a book in service of the story. I mean, we've got a detective who is a tough guy, which right now is not socially acceptable. We've got a beautiful woman who is very shapely, and right now that's offensive. We've got a femme fatale who at no point has any sort of physicality to her. All of her power rests within her being able to manipulate and the fact that she's intelligent and beautiful. I mean, these are all things that right now, for some reason, are not allowed or they're offensive.
Well, I think our vagina monster and our baby sacrifice are a little on the edge, too.
Probably not past anybody. I'm sure that wouldn't have been allowed. But, you know, that shock was there. I mean, also, 01 Publishing printed a book called The Sadist's Bible by Nicole Cushing that it's a good story, but it's a hard read, and it's incredibly, deeply blasphemous. And, again, see, no, it's the idea of it. I mean, if it was just a gore flick, hostile or I don't know, I'm not up on what's big right now, but if it was just, I don't know, how do I put this? We've seen plenty of films and read plenty of stories where debauchery is on display, where violence is on display, where horrible things are on display, and that in itself really isn't a challenge. I mean, it's kind of like saying, Nazis are bad. Yeah, no shit. But to actually take these things and put them into different contexts and get people to think about them, that's a different matter entirely, and that's where people start to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, we definitely aren't going to be doing torture porn, but, it's not like we're afraid to cross that line when the story calls for it.
Torture porn's cheap.
Yep, it's easy.
Yeah.
Quick thrill.
There's kind of been a resurgence in the early National Lampoon. There was a movie that just came out on Netflix about Doug Kinney. There's the documentary, what is it, Stoned, Drunk, Brilliant, Dead. And they talk about in their early days where, you know, the first issue, they just wanted to do stuff because they could. And then the second issue, it's like, well, we need it to look like a real magazine. We need it to be professional looking. So mm-hmm. that the stuff that they did was that much more both funny and transgressive.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I like about what you guys are doing, even though you're using the old tropes, mm-hmm. you know, you mentioned all the stuff from the noir. The only thing you're missing is at the end of the story, the detective is ruined and and the femme fatale has completely, you know, done everything she can to win. But you're using things that at one point were transgressive, and now they're kind of becoming transgressive again because society has a pendulum.
Yeah.
You know, things are okay, and then we go too far, and then it swings back, and we go too far.
Well, think about this. I've got a story about a tough guy. You know, or Patrick and I have got a story about a tough guy who is a little bit of a sexist. You know, you see, in the first book, he even tells Glenda, you're not getting out of this car. There are things in that house that a woman never should see, right? And, you know,
not realizing she knows a lot more than he does.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Not realizing she has seen far worse. And, you know, they love each other. You know, this book has a scene where they have some great sex. That, for some reason, is now right now the no safe space. Think about that. That's the no safe space right now. We've got a couple that's, you know, in somewhat traditional roles. I mean, neither of them really fit it. I mean, she's a woman of the 40s where, you know, things are changing. She runs her own business. She's very capable. And he's a guy come back from war and kind of broken. But at the end of the day, they're a loving couple and they have good sex in the book. That's apparently daring. Think about
whereas
that.
Whereas if you read the, you know, the crime novels of the 50s and 60s, your hero always had the Velda. You know, the strong, yeah. capable girl who also likes being in the sack with them.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, when you're 14, 15, you're going to read ahead to those spots.
Corey, did you read ahead to those spots in this book?
No, I read them in order.
Okay. You just dog-eared them when you got there, I know.
Well, I'm not going to say that they haven't been read more often than other pages, but...
Oh, God, I so much want to talk about them sticking together, but I'm not going to, because I'm a gentleman.
I treat my comics beautifully.
Okay. But even in the movies, the detective noir fiction... There was a heck of a lot of sex going on. They couldn't show it, but they were certainly implying it.
Oh, yeah. Well, and if you read the Travis McGee novels that I've mentioned a few times, it's almost like James Bond in that, okay, he's going to sleep with every woman who shows up in the book until you get to the 70s and the writer goes, wait a minute, he's old.
He was.
Now, I want to talk a little about marketing and things like that. So is Kat available to join in the conversation?
Well, the Skype situation's a bit of a pain in the ass, but I can hand it over to her.
All right. That'd be great, because I'd like to talk a little about what you're
speaking of loving relationships with having partners that are capable of different things, I have no problem admitting she is far more capable of knowledge in that area than me by a long shot.
And she could kick all our asses.
It depends on if it's a berserker rage. I can take it.
Yeah, I disagree, because I can curl up like a turtle, and she wouldn't be able to lay a finger on me.
Probably not. No, you got, you know, body armor going.
Exactly.
So one of the things that I want to talk about a little is 01 Publishing itself and how the company is growing, and how you do marketing in the current marketplace, where first off, there's this just an avalanche of product, just an endless avalanche of so much stuff. You guys made it to the top 20 on Amazon a few times. What are the things that you're doing that are working to get the word out about Case File Arkham and your other books?
Yeah, it's true. There's a ton of great stuff out there, and it is very easy to get lost. This last year, I do have to say the market took a huge shift. So I think everybody is all at once figuring out what the new ways of doing things are. Our best way of marketing is, word of mouth, using social media, getting out there, reaching out to people. Both Josh and definitely Patrick have been wonderful talking to, fans out there, being approachable, which really you need that. You need that whole bit of, creators are at arm's length really doesn't work anymore. People like being able to talk to their creators. And that has definitely been invaluable. I know Josh was mentioning earlier, reviews on Amazon. If our readers can, at the very least leave a, hey, it was awesome, that does wonders, because Amazon's computer uses that information to find other readers just like them and say, hey, if you liked this, then you'll also like this. Like currently on Amazon, it's telling people, hey, if you like Dresden, check out Case File Arkham. And that's the other thing is cross platforms. Before it had always been, you stick to comic books. You stick to like. But now, because so many more people are being interested in graphic novels and interested in the art form, telling people, hey, if you liked this prose book, check out this graphic novel. And it's amazing how many people will, come up to me in social media and even in person and say, I never would have thought to look at graphic novels to find new stuff. So basically, it's looking at new frontiers. There's a series of books I've been reading at the suggestion of our friend Nick Cole. Chris Fox's series of books, and it's mainly geared towards writers and how writers can get their stuff out there and how writers can make writing a career. He worked down the street from a lot of Amazon people, and they told him how the algorithm works, and so he used that to form his own career. So where that's all he does is he gets to write his own books every day, and his series of books talking about how writers can market themselves, I have found invaluable for my company. So,
and another thing I wanted to ask, I asked Josh and Patrick how they do their work. You're the editor. How do you fit into their process?
Well, I do have to say, working with Josh and Patrick is probably one of the easiest, editing jobs ever, because since they work off of each other and they edit each other, there's not all that much I have to do. But it basically what it is I, look over, I guess you'd call them the dailies, Patrick, of when you send pages. look over the dailies. This book especially, very rarely did I ever, send something back that says, nah, I'm not sure that works. Because they, police themselves so well. But, really I look for, if a page doesn't flow very well, if a panel maybe can be pushed a little farther, and definitely if verbiage in the speech bubbles isn't needed, because the worst thing you need is a speech bubbles filling up and crowding a panel. So,
one of the things that I mention a lot when I talk about 70s comics is just how overwritten they are.
Oh my God.
It's one of the beautiful things about comics that has changed in the last 20 years. because the writers think more visually, they're getting out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, the sun has risen on a beautiful day in New York City. It's, nope, here's your establishing shot. Here's this, here's this.
Yeah.
You probably haven't had to do it with Josh and Patrick, it sounds like. But with other creators, has there ever been a time when you've had to go, you've got a big plot hole here we need to figure out how to fill, or, you know, you're going down a blind alley, you're going to need to change things? Have you ever, as an editor, had to give direction for kind of a major change in something you're editing?
Mainly, it's been things like, I know where you're going with this, but, you know, a particular scene really isn't needed because what you're describing in that scene, is done better elsewhere. And it's mainly finding all the babies and killing them, really. I'm a baby killer.
Kill your darlings. You got to kill your darlings.
Yeah.
You do.
But we have so much less of that because of the technique that I think I'd mentioned since we're going back and forth, it allows Josh an opportunity to do a second and third pass on his script each time. And so, yeah, I do notice there's less and less word balloons on a page as we go through. I think, oh, that's interesting. 'Cause he'll imply something with his script that then I will reinforce with the art, and then he'll go back and say, well, don't need that anymore, you know, and jettison it, which is a great thing because some writers are very precious with their words, and they say, ooh, I turned this phrase just right, whereas Josh is willing to say, oh, well, you know, we don't need that anymore because we've got the visual, and that's pretty cool.
I think as a writer, it's one of the hardest things, too, because it's like, that's such a great phrase, but it doesn't move the story forward, so
yeah.
I'll put it over here. I'll put it in the file of I want to use this somewhere else sometime.
Yeah, everybody should, every writer should be forced to watch three or four Ed Wood movies. because that's what happens to a script that doesn't have a second draft.
Right.
Or any second editing of any sort.
Or even a second take, because he didn't like second take.
Oh, there were a few directors like that. William Bodine. I don't know if you guys have heard of him or not. He was called William One-Shot Bodine because he did everything in one shot. And all of his movies are terrible, but guess what? He got picked up for TV, and he directed hundreds of TV episodes, including episodes of the Batman TV show, because one take.
Right.
He got what he wanted in one take and moved on.
Well, you know, Ed Wood got a career in porn, so he moved on as well. So.
Yeah, I've seen one of those, and I've never seen more boring porn in my life.
Really?
Orgy of the Dead made stripping boring.
Oh my goodness!
Oh my God!
I've never even wanted to look at any of it because I have heard that it stars Ed Wood in scenes too, and that is something I just don't want to see.
Orgy of the Dead was basically just a bunch of strippers introduced by Criswell.
Oh my God. You know, that's really disappointing because his film Sinister Urge, if you ignore the fact that the writing is terrible and the acting is horrible and the scenes with the porn stars are incredibly boring, it's really a great view into that seedy life in Hollywood. And
yes.
And so it's kind of disappointing to hear that his pornos were just as boring as those parts of the film.
Well, and he wasn't part of the hardcore age that much. He
No.
was pretty much out of it by then. So a lot of his are just, you know, strippers. I don't. I can't think of a transition. So.
Well, real quick, this just makes me think. A friend of my parents went into porn, and they knew it was him in the porno movies because he was born with a tail. And he never had it removed. I don't know if it moved or not, but I just know he had a tail. And while they were, this was like right after college. I think they just got married and they went to one of those like dime machines where you put in a dime and you watch a little nudie flick, and they couldn't believe it. There he was in one of these stupid little dime movies.
made the bridge game that they had a little more interesting.
Exactly.
Well, rather than try and shoehorn a transition, I asked Josh about the difference between writing prose and writing comics, and he kind of blew me off. But in editing prose and editing comics, what's the biggest difference between those two?
Oh, that's a tough one. Because, yeah, you do have two mediums that you're playing with. Now, with these two, it's great because they work it out on their own. But really, because I am also a visual person, if I read a description of a scene and it's going panel by panel, there can be times where I will look at this and go, I don't know if that's really going to work, or how is that really going to make sense? Or I'll get back a page and go, this isn't what you described before. Why did you change this? I'm very glad that I don't have to work in a bullpen where it's an assembly line that things are more malleable, because I think assembly line work would drive me up the wall. Really, it's making sure that all of the scenes make sense and that people can tell what's going on in the panels, because that's the hardest thing for me, is making sure you can tell what's going on in the panel, especially if you're going to have large swaths of text, because you don't want the text to cover up what's going on or distract from the artwork and vice versa.
And then when it comes to prose, now I know you've got the two Cthulhu short anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
And Sadist Bible. What else has 01 Publishing put out? Any other prose books?
At this point in time, not yet, but we have lots of fun things planned for 2018. So we've got a cyberpunk dystopian fairy tale book coming out. And so that'll be a lot of fun. When it comes to short stories are different than novellas or novels, because with novellas and novels, you need to make sure that the narration doesn't drag, that you don't all of a sudden get stuck in a quagmire of descriptions or scenes that, again, aren't necessarily needed, that I can understand why the writer wants to expand upon the thought process going on in their protagonist's head, but it's boring. I don't need them pondering their mashed potatoes and peas for 2.5 pages when there's a war going on outside. That they can ponder their peas later, stuff like that. With short stories, it's a little easier, but at the same time, it's tougher because, you have to have a quick pace with a short story. You need to get your story out there and get it done. And so what I try to look for is quality of narrative. And what I mean by that is, this is going to sound horrible. Does the writer fall back on cliches too much? Does the writer fall back on dialogues and tropes that we've seen a gajillion times? Because then that tells me they're not reaching out to the extent that they can. They're not stretching themselves. They're falling back on old tropes, and nobody wants to, read the same thing over and over and over again. So that's what I look for when I edit short stories.
And you've got books coming out. You've got all this stuff. 01 Publishing, what conventions are you setting up at this year?
This year, we are looking at partnering with Mysterious Galaxy again for WonderCon. Still working things out for Comic-Con. And that's pretty much it. This year, we're... Oh, and I'm going to try to get us into Horrible Imaginings Film Festival, which is a wonderful film festival put on at Balboa Park every year, where they focus on indie horror movies. So if you're in the San Diego area around September, come out for that. But this year, we're not going to focus too much on going to shows. We're going to focus on getting books out and getting more wonderful stories out there to people.
And you've got a website. Go ahead and let people know what that is.
Well, our website is 01publishing.com. That's the number 0, the number 1, publishing.com. Very easy. And Patrick has his online portfolio. It's Megaflow Graphics.
That's correct. Megaflow Graphics, pretty much like it sounds, .com. And it's, yeah, where you can see all my my art and buy things and get in touch with me and give me work.
And Patrick, I was going to ask, are you going to be doing any conventions on your own?
None whatsoever. I actually have a pro badge for Emerald City just in case, but I'm probably not going to make it there. Not a big convention year for me at all. I probably won't be anywhere. So the only way to get in touch with me is through my website. So that's that makes it more important than ever. I might go up to San Diego if there's something crazy, wild, cool going on. I think I'm all set up for that, too. But again, it depends on if there's a pressing need for me to go. I went through a period from about 2002, I think, through 2010, where I went to every single San Diego Con, and I was going to a lot of gaming conventions and WonderCon every year, and I've gotten out of the habit. I think I've had my fill of cons, unless there's a need to be there. I've gone to Emerald City with Kat and Josh to launch some books, you know, things like that. But
that used to be a great con.
Yeah, but it's just not something I'm making a priority at this point. But who knows?
It's not in the Bay Area anymore. It's just not what it used to be.
Oh, WonderCon? WonderCon was fantastic when it was in the Bay Area. I wouldn't miss it. Yeah. And it was near my home. But now that it's down in L.A.,
I kind of have to agree.
So there we go. Sorry to disappoint all my legions of fans, my thousands and thousands strong who would want to come to see me, but no, not this year.
Women throwing themselves at you.
That's right. And now, boys, I won't discriminate. They can all.
And the Chinese matrons who want to give you white Russians, they're welcome.
That's right. Actually, I'm going to go out on a limb and say if I do show up in a con, anybody with a white Russian is welcome.
You heard it here. He's willing to be approached by Russians.
Yes.
Now, one last question I have.
I didn't
Kat...
get to me.
Okay. I thought Kat was... You show up places without Kat? Why would anybody want to talk to you if Kat's not there?
You know, that is actually a very interesting question.
He has completely devastated you with logic there.
No. I have my own website now.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, let us know.
It is jishirofinney.com.
And if people go there, what sort of wonderment is on the website?
Well, it's a general portfolio of my work. You can see some of my artwork. There's essentially a catalog to everything I've ever published. You can get signed copies of the books. And also, I would feel the most important part right now is that I'm trying to do weekly entries about, the art of writing, comics. I do reviews. And really lately, I've been focusing on the concept of why do people enjoy horror fiction, why it works, and what horror fiction affects me and why. And what I thought was going to be just kind of a very light, fun undertaking has kind of been a long, dark night of the soul. No, seriously, but it's worth checking out.
And the most recent journal entry is about The Exorcist.
Well, actually, The Exorcist and The Event Horizon.
Okay.
About why The Exorcist I found utterly hilarious and why The Event Horizon scares the hell out of me.
The funny thing is, I'm reading old Marvel magazines from the 70s.
Yeah.
And it's hard for us to put in our head just how shocking The Exorcist was when it came out.
Yeah.
And the other thing, you hear about, oh, it's one of the few movies where they had barf bags. The barf bags weren't for any of the sequences with the demonic stuff. It was the Spinal Tap sequence that freaked everybody out. And as I'm reading the interviews with the Marvel staffers, I mean, these are men in their 20s working at comics, and they're like, yeah, they started the Spinal Tap sequence, and I had to leave the theater for, I couldn't take it.
Well, did you actually read the whole entry or just kind of browse it?
I've read the first part of it because you just gave the website.
Oh, okay.
And I'd like to pay attention to what you're saying. Now, I don't have to if you don't want to.
I'd rather you didn't.
Now, well, actually, if you ever want to have me come on and talk about horror and my theory and behind it, I'd love to do that. But I don't think that's really in line with your show, right? Is it?
Oh, we talk about everything here, but I was going to ask, Kat mentioned something about 6 months ago. You guys were thinking about doing a podcast on noir films.
And is
that idea still floating out there?
Actually, it wasn't on noir. We had thought about noir films. Actually, what we've got now is we've decided to take the No Safe Space ethos to the web. And to a podcast, and it really is just an issue of I've got to sit down and finish editing them. We've got like 8 episodes recorded, and they're, every week we would sit down and discuss a book that breaks the mold and is not a safe space by modern standards. And the reason we started it was just I kept encountering people complaining that, there's just nothing out there to read anymore. I mean, lots of people are under the impression that if you like sci-fi, fantasy, or comics, you're just going to get this very watered-down, overly politicized boilerplate. I don't know. I could say very awful things about it. I'm not impressed with storytelling. I mean, Marvel for years has proven that you can tackle political subjects and make great stories. I mean, that was almost all of Chris Claremont's run. And the stuff they're producing now is just brain dead. So with so many people asking, well, you say there are books out there that are good to read that don't fall into this trap. And so we said, okay, screw it. We'll start doing a show where we review them. And I hope maybe in a month or so we can get this thing live because it's a lot of fun. A lot of cat rants.
Well, cool. When you get it done, let us know so that we can push it. And let people know, because one of the things that I think is really important is the fact that there's so much out there.
Yeah.
Just especially with people being able to self-publish on Amazon, there are hundreds of books that come out every month. Our local science fiction store sends out a newsletter. Here are all the books that are coming out over the next 3 months. And it's 30 pages. There's no way to sort through all of that.
Yeah.
It's just an avalanche, and TV's the same way. You have to ask people, all right, 15 new shows showed up on Netflix this month. Are any of them worth watching? Is any of it any good? So I think one of the things that podcasts and other creative people can do is kind of help people sort through what's worthwhile and what's not.
Yeah.
And it's why I like having you guys on the show, because I have yet to see anything from you from Utopiats on that hasn't been thought-provoking and well-made and sort of pushes your idea of what this kind of story can be. There are mashups all the time. I'm a big spaghetti western fan, and toward the end there was, okay, spaghetti westerns and comedy, spaghetti westerns and this, spaghetti westerns and that. And when you mix genres, you can come up with something very, very cool and unique, like Case File Arkham, or you could come up with Dracula and the Seven Golden Vampires, which is, okay.
I so need to see that.
Hammer and the Shaw Brothers are putting a movie together. And that it's exactly so what you wild. Thought it would be.
I wouldn't say it looks like a good film, but it looks like a lot of fun.
It's neither.
Really?
Really? It's just, yeah. It's just these, it's like pouring beer on Captain Crunch.
That's really disappointing.
Damn. Yeah. It's a fascinating failure.
Well,
I hope that's on my tombstone, actually. Here lies a fascinating failure.
Well, I love having you guys on the show. I love it when you come out with a new book. And just because we gave you a good review doesn't mean that, you know, we roll over for you. We only give good reviews to stuff we like. So Joe and I both really liked the book.
Thank you. That really did mean a lot. That was a great review. I was really, seriously very happy about that. Thanks again.
You mean it was better than There Are a Lot of Lines?
Oh, my God. It was funny. For longtime listeners, I suppose, Joe did not remember a thing about the first book. And, of course,
Joe doesn't remember anything.
And, of course, your other reviewer was intent upon coming up with non sequiturs throughout. So, so that was a very strange review. But this new one, oh yes, very nice.
Well,
there's
once
a lot
again,
of lines. Gonna... There's a lot like reading and stuff in it.
Your eyes can only take in so many lines during their lifetime, so you have to portion them
out
properly.
You have to parcel it out. It's why, you know, if you read some Brian Boland, you have to flip around and read some Ernie Kalan, you know, to kind of balance it out.
That's right. That's right.
Wait, no, Liefeld.
Yes, that'll.
You're tired of words, read some Liefeld.
That'll balance it out and also make you hate life. Yeah. Yeah, if you look at...
Although, I'll say this. Yeah. I don't like his stuff, but when it was popular, 12, 13, and 14-year-old kids thought it was the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah, that's true.
That's who it was for.
You can't take that away from it. Well, I got to tell you, I've made this confession several times, so it's not horrible. despite the fact that Liefeld is objectively not a very good artist at all. When he and the other Image folks were first doing their big Image thing back in the early 90s, I was picking them up and I was thinking, you know, this is excitement on the page. You can tell the people who are creating these things love what they're doing, and they are just as happy as the 12-year-olds that they're aiming these at. And I thought that was a new and different and exciting thing that really, popped comics into a higher gear for a little while there. You know, it all came down into horrible excess with terrible writing, but you know, for a year or so there, I was looking at them and saying, "Yeah, this is exciting stuff, and I'm glad it's happening." So you know, there's always good and bad.
There's nothing wrong with appealing to multiple audiences. You know, there should be mm-hmm. books in the store for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't tell you how many creators I talk to of a certain age, who that's their golden age, who I read that issue of Wetworks, and that's what made me want to draw comics. Or I read that issue of, you know, fill in the image book that now is in the 25-cent bin, where they were like, I read that, and I wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, there's some Golden Age stuff that,
oh
boy, Rob Liefeld had was sure a hell of a lot better than some of those guys.
Oh, yeah. 95% of the comic books that came out of the 1940s were horrible on every level. And you're right. Yeah, that's called the Golden Age, because the people who named it that were the ones who were 10 years old when they were coming out.
That's right.
I will give to Liefeld, as much as I think his art is terrible and his writing's even worse, the guy has a sense of humor about who he is and what he is. Yep. And has no problem laughing at himself. And you know what? That makes, you know, kind of like, okay, cool.
Yep. I can't disagree at all.
Well, I love having you guys on. That's why we do it so often. You're one of the few return guests that we have.
Yay.
So I want to thank you for putting aside the time. I want to thank Kat for badgering me into putting aside the time, because I'm so overwhelming and scatterbrained that it's like, oh yeah, I need to do that. So you've got a great editor there. I don't think there's anything from 01 Publishing that I haven't enjoyed. And I can't think of any other publisher I could say that about.
Wow.
Thank you.
Well, I love coming on, and anytime, Corey. I mean, this is a great show.
Well, maybe if you guys aren't going to do the stuff on noir films, maybe we can.
I'd love to do one. That would be great.
All right. Well, thanks again.
I haven't done an interview since, I'm looking back here, late September of last year. I'm looking to line up some more interviews, looking to do some more stuff. But also with Solitaire Rose Radio, when I started it, I wanted to do some more experimental stuff. So we've got some experimental stuff coming up this year. You're already listening to Crazy Comics and Stories, right? You are? Good. Because we've had a lot of fun lately. We did two episodes on our favorite comics of the 70s with Dan Moore, who I do Bad Advice with. That's at badadvice.solitairerose.com. New episode of that coming up in about a week. And Adam Vermilion from Panels and Pizza. And you can find Panels and Pizza. You know, they're one of our friends. One of the things that I like about what we're doing, I like to have other podcast people on the show. I like to kind of build a community of podcasters. I think that I think competition is silly. And I'm going to be talking about stuff like that. If you friend me on Facebook, just go over to Facebook, put in Corey Strode, and be my friend. Be my internet friend. But I post little mini essays about what I'm thinking about that day. Jokes, stuff about the upcoming show. One thing I don't talk about are our sponsors. I leave that for here. That's right, here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network, we have ads, and our first sponsor is me. That's right, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. I have my first book out with Dangerous Dan Moore. It's the first 100 strips of our online web strip, Worldwide News, the story of the lowest-rated cable news network. And you can get yourself a copy with commentary, with all sorts of extras, with signatures and everything. Just email Dan over at lordshadowflame@gmail.com. Our top sponsor, who's been with us since day one, is DreamHost. DreamHost.com. You need yourself a website, and DreamHost.com is the number one web host in the whole known universe. Just head over to DreamHost.com, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, get $20 off your first year. How can you beat that? Our other sponsor is Graze, G-R-A-Z-E.com. Healthy snacks for a healthy lifestyle. Just head over to Graze, put in the code CORYS3R5P. Your first and fifth box are free. You could get them weekly. You could get them bi-weekly. You could get them monthly. You just order a whole bunch of them. It's great stuff to keep you away from the vending machine at work. Now, if you would like to leave a comment for any of the podcasts that we do, we'd love those. Go ahead and email us at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, or you can call 952-856-0519. Operators are standing by. Okay, it's just a place that we'll record your calls, but we'll play them on the air. We'll answer your questions. We love getting feedback. Tell us what you think. Ask a question. Suggest a topic. Be a guest. Send us your stuff. SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. If you would like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose radio shows, you can. Just email us at SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. Subject, advertising. Thanks. And there you go. Once again, head on over to 01 Publishing. Buy this book. I enjoy this book. I enjoy the previous book. I enjoy World War Kaiju, which came out, 3 years ago now. And they've got two Cthulhu short story collections there. They've got a really cool horror novel called The Sadist Bible. Got all kinds of stuff over there. So go ahead, head on over to 01publishing.com. Tell them we sent you. I doubt they'll throw in an extra goodie like Joe does if you go over to his eBay page. But, you know, they'll smile, they'll wave, they'll be nice to you. Well, as nice as they can for a bunch of people who put together really cool horror books. I want to thank you for listening. And we'll be back soon with more stories. Ow! Another fine podcast from Solitaire Rose Networks.
The end.